From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in for the next couple of weeks while Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's show, I speak with Dr. Andrew Weil. Weil's an MD who studies and uses alternative forms of healing. Also today, I speak with authors Ethel Ann Vare and Greg Patachik. Their new book, Mothers of Invention, chronicles women's discoveries from the bra to the bomb. Rock historian Ed Ward usually shares the best in rock and roll with us. Today, Ward picks the worst music ever recorded. And book critic John Leonard reviews Japanese writer Kobo Abe's surreal view of the clash between society and environment. That's all ahead on today's Fresh Air. For the past 20 years, Dr. Andrew Weil has been a pioneer in expanding the boundaries of medicine. His unorthodox approach to medicine started early. While an undergraduate at Harvard in the early 1960s, he wrote a paper for a botany course titled Nutmeg as a Narcotic. The paper was so good, it was published. Weil did go on to receive his MD from the Harvard Medical School and then served as assistant surgeon in the U.S. Public Health Service at the National Institute of Mental Health. But Weil's interest in ethnopharmacology led him away from a traditional career in medicine. He began traveling throughout North America, South America, and Africa, studying indigenous medicine, psychoactive plants, and altered states of consciousness. He's written four books based on his research, which include The Natural Mind, A New Way of Looking at Drugs and the Higher Consciousness, and Chocolate to Morphine, Understanding Mind-Active Drugs. Another of Andrew Weil's books, Health and Healing, has just been revised and updated. It provides a look at medical practices from herbal remedies to biotechnology. Weil teaches at the University of Arizona College of Medicine and has a private practice in Tucson. Andrew Weil, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Faith.
Now, when you wrote Health and Healing 5 years ago, it was described as a pioneering look at non-traditional medicine. Are you happy with how things are being accepted now?
I think so. I see many different trends operating, but in general, there is more interest on the part of patients in other forms of treatment. There is more pressure on regular doctors to be open to some of the new findings about connections of mind and body and to pay attention to the successes of alternative forms of treatment. So yes, I think I am happy with the way things are going.
I know, though, that you've been working on this personally for about 20 years, and it makes me wonder if you haven't become impatient after all this time.
It would be easy to do that in some ways because there is so much that I see, so many ways I see in which regular medicine could shift and become much more effective, could satisfy the needs of the population so much better. And yes, it's possible to get impatient with that. A few weeks ago, the AMA's newspaper, weekly newspaper, had a front page article decrying the numbers of patients seeking help from quack medicine, and everything other than MD medicine was lumped together under the heading of quack medicine. So that kind of thing makes me impatient.
I noticed that you got your medical degree at Harvard originally, and then you did your internship, and you decided not to go on with training in regular medicine. Why not?
For two reasons, one emotional and one philosophical. The emotional reason was that, in general, I felt that the methods I was being taught were not things I'd want done to me if I were sick, and so I didn't feel comfortable doing them to other people. The other reason was that it seemed to me a lot of the way that I was being taught to treat illness did not go to the root causes of illness and undo them. Instead, they were methods that masked the expressions of illness or blocked illness, suppressed the symptoms of illness. And that didn't feel right to me. And I would argue that a lot of what we do in regular medicine is of that suppressive nature. For instance, the way we treat allergies and autoimmune disease is essentially suppressive. The way we treat mental illness is suppressive. The way we treat many common conditions simply masks illness. It does not undo it. I wanted to find out other ways.
You mean surface treatment, not root treatment?
Surface treatment, not root treatment.
Well, what is your philosophy of treatment?
Let me give you an image. One of the systems that I studied as an alternative form of healing was homeopathy, a system that looked for a time as if it were going to become the dominant system of medicine in this country in the last century, and it was centered here in Philadelphia. The founder of homeopathy, Samuel Hahnemann, a German physician who did his work at the end of the 1700s and early 1800s, formulated a principle that makes a lot of sense to me. He said it was very dangerous to suppress surface illness. The example he used was an inflamed condition of the skin. He said that if you drove that inward, the disease would surface later in worse forms or invade more vital structures of the body. And he wrote that long before we had the corticosteroids, cortisone and its relatives, which are very, very effective ways of suppressing skin inflammations. If you think of the body as a pot full of water and the disease process as a fire underneath the pot, the symptoms of disease are the agitation of the water and the steam coming off. What you want to do in treatment is turn the fire off. A lot of our treatments are like putting a lid on the pot. Immediately they make the symptoms go away. But what are the long-term consequences of doing that?
So you say in your book that your philosophy is use any reasonable method that works as long as it doesn't cause harm.
Right, and I don't really care where those methods come from. I at this point, I don't have allegiance to any particular system of medicine. I have, over the years, worked with and studied osteopaths, chiropractors, naturopaths, herbalists, faith healers, shamans, witch doctors, Chinese doctors. I think all of them have something to teach. All of those systems have elements of truth. There is no system that has a monopoly on truth in treatment. And I take from all of them. And as I said, I really believe in using whatever works as long as it doesn't cause harm, including those treatments of regular medicine, which are right and effective.
Well, some people call those things fringe medicine. Mm-hmm. What do you call it?
I think it's a political choice as to what words you use. I guess commonly I refer to orthodox and unorthodox medicine. The term alternative medicine suggests that you're doing these things in place of regular treatment. And that's not always the case. In England, the term complementary medicine has come into general use, and I like that. It suggests that these other systems complement regular medicine and balance its excesses and deficiencies. And I hope that one trend we'll see in the future is the development of clinics where practitioners of various traditions can work together under the same roof.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil. Do you think that England uses the term complementary medicine because people there are more open to these kinds of things?
Yes, and I think some of that is due to the royal family's support of these kinds of medicines, especially homeopathy, to the very prominent tradition of herbalism in England, and I think to much greater interest in mind-body interactions than here in America. So I think there probably are several reasons that account for that.
I read in your book that you took mind-altering substances yourself and also researched them here and in other countries to find out what.
Initially, when I was a student at Harvard Medical School, I was interested in marijuana and its effects, and there had been very little research on it. And then I expanded that to research on a variety of hallucinogenic plants, which I studied in a number of native cultures in South America and elsewhere. I was interested in how people's expectations of the effects of those drugs determined their effects. And I have amply confirmed the suspicion that expectations, or set and setting, as psychologists say, are at least as important as pharmacology in determining people's responses to these mind-active drugs.
You mean they were almost like placebos?
Almost like placebos, but they're not sugar pills because these drugs have effects of their own. And I think that that period of research, when I studied psychoactive drugs, is very relevant to my present work in alternative medicine, because the general conclusion that I came to was that the experiences that people have on these drugs really come from their own nervous systems, that the drugs elicit them or trigger them, but they're from inside. And now what I'm saying in regard to healing in general is that healing is also a potential of the human mind and body. We don't put healing into other people with treatments. We elicit it.
So there you are, wandering through, say, the jungle in Africa or in South America, experimenting with these plants, taking them yourself. What was that like?
Difficult at times, fun at times, frustrating. I never came to harm. I have good guardian angels, and I have a good sense of the limits of what I can experiment with. But I do make, as a general rule for myself, that I don't recommend treatments to other people that I haven't experienced myself, whether that's going to another practitioner or taking a plant. As you know, I use a lot of medicinal plants in my practice today as a result of my background in botany and my studies. I think for every prescription I write these days for a pharmaceutical drug, I probably give out 40 or 50 for botanical remedies.
Did you ever take one of those plants, chew it, ingest it somehow, and say, oh, I hope I haven't made a mistake on this one?
Yes, not often. But I think the human body is quite resilient. And as long as you are sure in advance that something is not going to kill you, I think you have a lot of latitude to experiment. And the worst that's going to happen to you is you're going to get sick for a little while.
I read that you wanted to invent a cocoa leaf chewing gum. Did you ever do that?
Well, this was in the innocent days before cocaine had become the problem it has today in our culture. I worked a lot with Indian tribes that use coca leaf, both as a stimulant and as a medicinal agent. I was particularly interested in its medicinal effects on the gastrointestinal system, for example.
Meaning it would do what?
That it is a great benefit in treating conditions like ulcer and esophagitis and intestinal imbalance. And I was interested in particular about the low abuse potential of the leaf compared to isolated cocaine and what lessons we could draw from that. I found it impossible to pursue those studies just because of the continued abuse of cocaine up here and the prominence surrounding that.
Well, are people now less willing to hear you talk about those things in this anti-drug atmosphere?
I tend, you know, most of what I talk about and write about today is not about psychoactive drugs, but about mind-body and healing and alternative medicine. If people ask me to talk about drugs, I certainly do, though I tend to talk most about the legal drugs in our culture today, alcohol, tobacco, and coffee and chocolate. Because I think most of us are ignorant of the nature of those substances, their potential for addiction and potential to cause us harm.
Did you stop doing it, though, by choice or because you felt it just wasn't going to fly?
I'd say both. I think that that has become such an emotional issue in our culture today that it's just very difficult to talk about. And I think I'll wait for a time when people are more open again.
You think that's a long way off?
I don't know.
One thing that intrigued me in your book, you talked about every person's body being different. So different treatments work for different people. Have I got that right?
Yes. I think that is also why different diets work for different people. You know, we are biochemically unique, each of us. We're anatomically unique, physiologically unique. And that makes it very difficult to recommend treatments or programs that are going to work for everybody. A lot of people these days tell us we have to eat this way or that way. People find a way of eating that works for them and say that everyone else has to eat that way. Same with drugs. Medical students are very poorly prepared by their education for the extreme variability in reactions of patients to drugs. You can read in a book what a drug is supposed to do to people based on animal experiments and human testing, and then you go out in the real world and give these drugs to people, and they react all different ways.
Do you think every medical student should take these drugs?
You know, I don't think it's a bad idea for doctors to have taken treatments themselves. A colleague of mine who was a director of psychiatric residency training at a major psychiatric teaching hospital in the Northeast required that all of his residents take one dose of every medication that they prescribed. And as a result of that, the medicating in that hospital was significantly lower than that in most psychiatric hospitals.
You know, if every person's body reacts differently to drugs, how would they be able to tell whether it was just an individual reaction or a reaction that might affect large numbers of people?
Well, if you give the drug under controlled circumstances to relatively large numbers of people, you can get, with some confidence, a sense of what the general effects are, and that is the value of doing that kind of testing. But still, whenever you're in an individual situation, you give a drug to a person, you must always be prepared for unique, or what we call idiosyncratic reactions, some of which can be toxic.
If everybody is different, how do you make sense of health generalizations or policies like smoking is bad?
Good question. again, I think all you can do is have some statistical sense of the dangers or benefits of certain courses of action. In the case of cigarettes, I'm sure you have met people in their 70s and 80s who have smoked two packs of cigarettes all their lives and are hale and hearty and can march up hills better than we can. And that means probably that those people have healthy constitutions and strong respiratory systems, and that their enzymes for repairing cellular damage from that might cause cancer are in good working order. That doesn't mean that everybody can smoke with license. It doesn't work that way, but some people can do it.
Should you have a policy?
I think, again, that that should be based on statistical considerations. In the case of cigarettes, I think the statistical risks of cigarette smoking are great enough to warrant a policy, especially since in the case of cigarettes, non-users are exposed to that substance. And there is accumulating evidence that passive inhalation of cigarette smoke can be a significant factor in disease.
My guest is Dr. Andrew Weil. He's been a longtime pioneer in the field of holistic health. A revised edition of his book, Health and Healing, has just been published. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
This is Dr. Andrew Weil, author of Health and Healing. Do you believe in physicals?
I guess no, not on a regular basis. I think that it is good to have a sense of your own body, to go in for specific kinds of tests. But in the absence of trouble, if you are taking good preventive measures, now those are two big ifs, I don't think it is necessary to have an annual physical.
Why do I get the feeling that presidents benefit by them?
Well, I think they have great publicity value.
Well, you know, it seems like every time they take one, they find something.
And that's a danger, by the way. I think there is a danger of going looking for trouble in the absence of any visible signs of trouble. I think it is better to put energy into good preventive maintenance. Now, a lot of people in this culture don't want to do that. I mean, there is an attitude that's quite prevalent of being very passive. You know, the idea is that you can do whatever you want, and there are going to be doctors waiting at the end of the line to rescue you from the results of your folly, whether that's giving you a new heart or something like that. I think it is much better to put energy into preventive maintenance.
Well, do they find things on presidents because they use special equipment on them that they don't use on us?
Well, some presidents are very old.
Yeah. Do you believe in the connection between emotion and state of health?
Sure. And I think that any clinician who is sensitive to the emotional states of his or her patients sees many kinds of conditions that fluctuate with the ups and downs of a person's emotional life. I think that's especially true of autoimmune diseases and allergies, for example, that if you look at a condition like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, these are major autoimmune diseases. These are diseases that tend to vary, that they have remissions and exacerbations, and these ups and downs often correlate with ups and downs of people's emotional state.
Is there a danger, though, that when it comes to the emotion-health connection, that will cause patients to blame themselves for their illnesses?
Of course there is, and I think we're doing that already. That's especially, I see that happening a lot in alternative approaches to cancer, where some physicians and other kinds of workers suggest to patients, and sometimes say as much directly, that people gave themselves cancer, or you got cancer because you bottled up your emotions or didn't express anger. That doesn't do any good. I mean, all that does, as far as I can see, is to saddle people with cancer with a great deal more guilt and despair than they've had to begin with, and that's counterproductive. If, in fact, you take seriously the idea that guilt and depression and grief can suppress immunity, which I think they can, then you want to work as a physician to relieve people of that kind of burden, not to add to it.
How do you behave when you're sick?
Well, you ought to ask the people around me. I don't get sick that often, and when I do, I usually know how to take care of myself. I don't usually have need to go to outside practitioners, and I recommend that as the best course of action. I think it is good to find ways to be more self-reliant in terms of illness. So, you know, I do all the things I know how to do, and if it's bad enough, I stay in bed for a few days.
Do you feel sorry for yourself?
Yeah, sure. I feel sorry and I feel angry, and I think those are often normal parts of being sick. One of the principles that I wrote about in my book is that it's all right to be sick. I don't think getting sick means that you failed in some way or that you're to be blamed. I think sickness is part of life, that there are alternations of being in the relative balance of health and having that balance break down periodically. I think that's just part of the way things are. And I think it helps if you don't obsess too much about feeling guilty or angry about that state, but just let it pass and get through it as efficiently as possible.
When you were growing up, how did the people around you, say your parents, treat you when you were sick?
Oh, I think they took good care of me. I remember I have a lot of pleasant memories of being in bed as a kid and reading comic books and, you know, getting things I didn't get to eat all the time. And I remember that experience.
Does that affect the way that you're a doctor now?
It must. I'm not sure I can say exactly how. I have a general practice. I see a wide variety of patients with many sorts of conditions. I see people who are well and simply want preventive medical assessments, which I strongly encourage, and I see people with overwhelming diseases. And I think the main strategy that I try to use is to empower people to deal better with their own problems. That is to give them information and techniques and resources by which they can maximally use their own potential for healing.
Dr. Andrew Weil, the author of Health and Healing, among other books, is my guest. Do you still have your tonsils?
No, I it was very difficult. I'm now 45 and I grew up here in Philadelphia. And in my generation, I think it was almost impossible for a child to make it to adolescence with tonsils. That was because the medical profession taught that tonsils were useless organs, functionless organs, and that gave surgeons the license to take them out at the first sign of trouble. We now know that tonsils and adenoids are vital structures of the immune system, and they're there for a very good purpose, which is to facilitate meetings between immune tissues and germs that might enter the body by that route and help us develop lifelong immunity. It's interesting, by the way, that almost every major organ of the immune system until very recently was considered a functionless organ.
Well, you said in your book that tonsils really were an example of the trendy operations, things being taken out in droves.
And one of the lessons of some of this, there's a worse case with the thymus gland, which I also cited in the book. This is the gland behind the breastbone that's the master gland of the endocrine system. And even when I was in medical school, its function was little understood, just beginning to be understood. But for years, doctors had taught that this was a functionless organ. It shrank in adolescence, and that was taken proof that it was functionless. In the 1950s, doctors at leading academic medical centers invented a disease that every child had called thymic hypertrophy, meaning the thymus is too large, treatable by shooting X-rays at it, which makes it shrivel up immediately. And this was done to large numbers of children of middle-class and upper-class parents in this country. Years later, we find that many people that had this treatment developed thyroid cancer because of the radiation exposure in that region. I think that when you read accounts of this, which the medical profession would like us to forget, it ought to make us wary of new treatments. You know, what are the things we're doing today that we're going to look back on 20 or 30 years from now with the same open-mouth disbelief that we hear of this episode of bombarding thymuses with X-rays?
You've joined the list of people who publicly criticize their own professions. I think that as I hear you criticizing them now. Mm-hmm. How does it feel when your colleagues get mad at you?
I don't find that happens very often anymore. And that to me suggests that the medical profession is a bit more open than it was before. The University of Arizona College of Medicine asked me to teach there on this subject. They asked for teaching about alternative systems of medicine and other kinds of medical philosophies. The economic crunch on medicine is so great right now that I think it's forcing some openness in ideology which wasn't there previously. And the demand for among patients for other kinds of treatments is so great that I think at least some doctors are willing to listen to all this. So I don't find that so much.
What about your difficulty in non-traditional health meetings? Are there people there who expect you to embrace everything they're doing?
Absolutely, and I will not do that. I see, as you know, an awful lot of nonsense that goes on under the banner of alternative medicine and holistic medicine. Many holistic practitioners embrace methods of unproved value and reject everything orthodox as wrong, and that's not the way it should be. If I have any complaint, it's that sometimes I feel rather lonely being in the middle. You know, that I try to stake out a middle line of taking, as I said, the best of all these systems and synthesizing a new kind of medical practice. I guess you'd call it a kind of eclectic medicine that takes the best elements of all of these.
So you do feel like a middleman.
Yes.
When medical journals come out with articles and say one thing, and then they come out with articles the next week and say completely the opposite, we don't know what to do. What are we supposed to do? What do you do?
Well, you know, I think there ought to be a course for people as to how to interpret medical research, because you just can't believe the results of everything that you see. You have to judge it on how well the data were gathered and whether the experiments were done correctly. A lot of cases, that's not true. An awful lot of medical research is not of very good quality.
So in the end, do you think that we should all be shooting for perfect health?
Perfect health is not obtainable. I think any system or person that tells you that you can be healthy forever if you do this or that is not to be believed. Health is a temporary state of balance and alignment with all the forces inside and out of you. And part of its nature is that it breaks down from time to time in order to realign. So the vision of perfect health forever is a fantasy.
What are we supposed to be shooting for?
I think we're supposed to be shooting for a kind of resilience or bounciness or springiness that allows us to move through a world filled with potentially dangerous agents and not get seriously hurt by them a lot of the time. That if things come at us that knock us off balance, whether it's a flu or an injury, that we bounce back from that as quickly as possible. And that's mostly by taking advantage of our own internal resilience.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I've enjoyed this. My guest has been Dr. Andrew Weil. His book, Health and Healing, has just been revised and updated. It's a survey of alternative healthcare practices, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with New York Times reporter Hedrick Smith. He's just written the book, The Power Game, How Washington Works. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. Coming up, I speak with Ethel Ann Vair and Greg Patachik. For their book, Mothers of Invention, the pair discovered that women had a hand in creating everything from the ice cream cone to the first computer. Also, you'll have your hands in your ears when rock historian Ed Ward plays his picks for the worst music ever recorded. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Ark Sakura, the new novel from Japanese writer Kobo Abe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Two top Justice Department officials resigned abruptly today. William Weld, the chief of the criminal division, and Arnold Burns, the number two deputy to Attorney General Edwin Meese, quit their jobs, along with four of their aides. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Weld and Burns met early this morning with Attorney General Meese and, according to Justice Department sources, told the Attorney General that the ongoing investigations and the continual revelations involving Meese's financial ties to his friend E. Robert Wallach were hurting the department. According to sources, Weld and Burns told Meese bluntly that he should not continue as the nation's chief law enforcement officer and that in view of Meese's refusal to resign, Weld and Burns did not want to stay on at the Justice Department. At the White House, a spokesman said the president still supports the attorney general, and the White House sought to portray the resignations as routine in the waning months of any administration. At the Justice Department, the attorney general spokesman conceded the resignations were orchestrated, but the spokesman said he knew of no policy dispute that triggered the resignations. Both Weld and Burns avoided reporters all day. When Weld was finally cornered this afternoon, he refused to specify the reasons for his resignation and said only, "I'm going fishing." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Demonstrations continue in Israel's occupied territories, despite curfews and measures to seal off the territories. Eight Palestinians were wounded in clashes with Israeli soldiers. Also today, two Israeli soldiers were given jail sentences for burying four Palestinians alive. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
A military court found that the two Israeli soldiers had disgraced the Israeli army and sentenced them today to jail terms. The case stirred controversy inside the country over the military's policy to end the Palestinian uprising. The soldiers had buried four Palestinians alive during a roundup of demonstrators in the village of Kafr Salem. Villagers rescued the four and took them to the hospital. Meanwhile today, thousands of police have been deployed near Arab towns and villages inside Israel in preparation for Land Day, observed by Arab citizens of Israel. The day will be marked by strikes and demonstrations to commemorate the deaths of six Arabs killed during protests against expropriation of land by the government 12 years ago. In an agreement with Israeli Arab leaders, the police are remaining outside of the towns and villages unless there's violence to avoid provocations. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
The United States today expressed outrage at yesterday's attack by Panamanian forces on journalists and opposition leaders. Troops stormed the Marriott Hotel in Panama City to break up a planned news conference by opponents of the regime of Manuel Noriega. Several American journalists were beaten and detained, and a number of political leaders were arrested. State Department spokesman Charles Redman.
This raid on the Marriott Hotel was a shocking demonstration of the anti-democratic nature of the Noriega regime and Noriega's alarming willingness to use brutal tactics as his position in Panama deteriorates. We remind those directing this crackdown that we take the welfare of U.S. citizens abroad very seriously. As always, we'll do what is necessary to protect U.S. citizens.
At the White House, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. does not plan to take military action against the Noriega regime, but he said the U.S. is growing impatient and it's important to know there are limits. 22 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean today criticized American economic sanctions against Panama. The nations crossing the political spectrum from communist Cuba to the right-wing government of Chile said they would consider a Panamanian request for economic aid. Disgraced preacher Jimmy Swaggart has been suspended for 1 year following what he calls his moral failure. A prostitute says Swaggart paid her to pose naked for him at a New Orleans motel room. Church officials also ordered Swaggart to undergo 2 years of rehabilitation. Stock prices closed higher today in moderate trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 18 points to close at 1998. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Friday is April Fool's Day, a day when even your most straight-laced friend might try to trick you. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward thought about what gags he could perpetrate, but then he had a better idea.
With April Fool's Day coming up, I was sorely tempted to go into a recording studio with a bunch of non-professional musicians and make some tapes that I'd try to pass off as some unknown band from the past, only to holler April Fool at the end and let everybody in on the joke. But why go to all the trouble to make a bad record when there are already so many around? Now, bad records come in many forms. For instance, there are bad records that are just incredibly dull, made worse by having self-conscious, pretentious lyrics tacked onto them.
That's me. That's me. And I know it's how I'm always gonna be. Nothing to do, nothing to say, nothing to hope, and nothing to I can't see, I can't feel, I've forgotten what I meant to be. Won't come back, not if I try. They told me things about me that I didn't know, but I could tell they told me lies that really go to show that everyone was wrong and they don't understand my ways. But it's not me that's going wrong, it's them.
That, for instance, was a group of rich kids who met at a prep school outside of London and formed a band from the ruins of two other bands, The Anon and The Garden Wall. Yes, folks, that was Genesis' first single, That's Me, recorded in 1968 before they met Phil Collins. And yes, that was Peter Gabriel singing lead. Then there are bad records that are supposed to be bad, to cash in on the novelty market. For instance, a bunch of weirdos in Nashville heard Simon and Garfunkel's Silent Night 7 o'clock news and recorded this.
For Hunt Hall was over a year last week, and they hope sometime he'll return it. Here's the plate scores just in. 69, 5, 3, and 2. Pontus Wee-Wee meets Lorenzo Lenoir in the medium light heavyweight bake-off this Thursday at Swish Pavilion. And this is the 5:15 Sports.
They called themselves the fastest group alive, and I guess you can see why you've never heard of them. And what are we to make of The Residents, a bunch of art students from Louisiana who moved to San Francisco in the 70s and began putting out resolutely ugly records that are not without their fascination or their following. That was the old favorite, Satisfaction, wasn't it? Yes, it was. But the bad records that really live on in history are the sincere ones, the ones made with the same intentions that good records are made with. Take the case of a song called Paralyzed, which actually got released on a major label, Mercury, with full promotion and everything. It was cut by Norman Odom, who calls himself the legendary Stardust Cowboy. Norman grew up in Lubbock, Texas, where he was considered fairly weird by his high school peers for giving bugle concerts at the local hamburger drive-in and painting his car with views of the solar system, all of this well before LSD ever came to Lubbock. But Norman followed his dreams, odd as they were, and showed up at the office of Fort Worth's pop wizard, Major Bill Smith. Smith had already given us another kind of bad record, Hey Paul, Hey Paula by Paul and Paula. Odom told the Major that he was the legendary Stardust Cowboy and wanted to make a record. The Major, for his part, knew that kids in 1968 liked stuff that he didn't understand, so he put Norman in the studio with a young man named T-Bone Burnett. Here's what happened next.
Back out to yourself! Box Max, follow me slow, girl,
That's a little more than half of Paralyzed, but it ought to give you the idea. What's even weirder is that Paralyzed has become a cult record, re-released over and over, making the top 10 in Australia, and even re-recorded a few years ago when The Ledge, as his friends call him, made an album of his new songs. Record collectors tend to prize the bad records they find, and each has a favorite. My friend Dick Blackburn uncovered a gem called Lucille, Are You a Lesbian?, in which a man who obviously was disappointed by his date with Lucille pours out a stream of bile at the poor woman. He sounds pretty drunk, and the record ends when he realizes that his sister's been seen a lot with Lucille, so she must be a lesbian too, at which point he starts crying. But at a recent playoff, Lucille lost to another record. Gary Rice picked up a 45 by Buster Brown and the Shoemakers because he thought it was the same Buster Brown who recorded the hit Fannie Mae. It was on a Memphis label, so it was a reasonable guess. But no way, Jose. Here is Closer, Girl.
Closer, girl, than ever before. I want to love you more.
Something I've said and done to make you feel this way, I do, yes I do.
Ugh. Bad records are still being made every day. Last weekend I heard a gem on a blues station in Louisiana called She Was Chewing Gum. But I think we've heard enough for today. Remember, this is no April Fools. All of these records are real.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
If there's something I've said and done to make you feel this way, I do.
This is Fresh Air. History is full of women inventors who've been ignored. That's the premise of a new book called Mothers of Invention, From the Bra to the Bomb, by Ethel Anvere and Greg Potacek. In researching the book, the authors learned that women have played an important role in many scientific discoveries that men have been credited for. Women have also been the brains behind such everyday items as the Melita coffee filter, disposable diapers, brown paper bags, and the ice cream cone. Until now, much of Vare and Potacek's work as writers has been about sports or entertainers. I asked them how this book came about.
Greg and I were editing Rock magazine at the time, and we had assigned out a story about Michael Nesmith, the Monkees' reunion, and Nesmith's upcoming television show back then called Elephant Parts. And one of the things that turned up in the story as we were reading it was that Nesmith had no need to rejoin the Monkees because he didn't need the money because he had inherited $25 million upon the death of his mother from her royalties of her invention of liquid paper. That was Betty Nesmith Graham. And I sat there saying, gee, you don't think of women as inventing much of anything. And Greg said, yeah, you know, there's almost a book in that. And the writer of the piece, Vicky Jo Radofsky, said, you could call it The Mothers of Invention. And that was it. The book was born.
How did you find out about all these women?
Well, actually, it was a task a lot more difficult than we originally thought. Originally, we thought we could access books that were on women inventors and then take it from there. But we found out in the initial round of research there weren't any books on women inventors. And in fact, those books that had inventors in them, almost to the one, did not include any women. So fortunately, computer technology aided us a lot in our research. We were able to scan the Library of Congress, and we also had a team of researchers working in New York, in London, even one in Germany for a while. So it was a multi-pronged effort.
Were you stunned when you checked out the Inventors Hall of Fame?
Well, it seemed a little annoying that, and in fact, we have double-checked to make sure that no women have been inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame in the 2 years since we did the research for this book. And even in the 85 and 86 inductions, there are still no women included in the Inventors Hall of Fame. And it just seems like some of the inventions by women are every bit as earth-shaking as some of those that have qualified for induction in the Hall of Fame. But all the Hall of Famers are male.
Well, what about your own Hall of Fame? Which women would you put in it?
My two particular favorite inventor/discoverers are Dr. Lisa Meitner, who first coined the term and identified the concept of nuclear fission, who did publish before Enrico Fermi and did it while she was fleeing the Nazis. She was a German-Jewish scientist working at the beginning of World War II and pretty much did her calculations while in the hold of a boat on the way to Denmark in safety. Hmm. And one of my other favorite ladies invented the bra in 1911, who was a free-spirited debutante named Polly Jacob, who later changed her name to Caress Crosby, who found corsets much too confining for an evening's dance. And so she took some silk handkerchiefs and thread and instructed her maid on how to sew them together to give her a much less confining upper body support system, and then did patent the bra. So actually the bra and the bomb ladies are two of my favorite ladies.
She changed her name to Caress Crosby?
Well, she married into Crosby, and Caress was her own idea. Yes, she was very much a bohemian of her day. She rode naked down the Champs-Élysées on a baby elephant.
How about you, Greg?
This is a case of a woman seizing an opportunity and just going with it. It was Nicole Barbe Clicquot. She, in effect, revolutionized winemaking by inventing the process of clarifying sparkling wines. When the monk Dom Perignon invented champagne, the first sparkling wine, he could never figure out how to get the sediment out without losing the effervescence. And so it was always sort of a novelty wine. And when Nicole Barbe Clicquot came onto the scene, she was a young widow of only 3 years, and her husband had left her a vineyard in the Champagne district of France. This is around the Napoleonic Wars. And she just figured that there must have been there must be a better way to make sparkling wine, and that in fact this could open up a whole new market for the French wine industry. And so she invented the current method of making champagne, which is still in use today, and also in the process, just for fun, she invented pink champagne.
Now, which inventor heads the list in the big surprise category? Hedy Lamarr surprised me.
And the odd thing is we still have not been able to get Miss Lamarr to admit that she invented or co-invented this secret communication system, which was ready for use, but not, so far as we've been able to discover, actually used in the Second World War. She is listed on the patent under her given name as the co-inventor of the secret communication system, and yet in her own autobiography and in any interview that she's ever done, she has never cop to the fact that she was involved in this invention. But her name is right there on the patent, and how many Hedwig Keisler Markies could there have been living in Los Angeles in 1942? So it has to be she.
Yeah. The dark side of all this is that there were women scientists who invented things and told the world about it, and nobody believed them. And there were women who invented things and then saw companies steal their ideas. And then there were women who invented things only to see their male professors claim the credit. When you finished all your research about all of them, were you mad?
We tried not to get into a state of high dudgeon. It was... in fact, there have been some people in reading Mothers of Invention and talking about it who felt that it should be a more feminist political book, that there should be more anger in Mothers of Invention about what these women had to endure throughout history. There are little facts strewn about, like that it was illegal for a woman to have more than a grade school education up until the 1860s, that a woman had no legal right to her own property until the 1850s, that the women couldn't vote until the 1920s. The facts are in there, but we tried not to approach it with a sledgehammer, but rather show the positive side of these remarkable women and the obstacles that they overcame.
If you look at women's history books, you realize there are always people who uncover information like this. They write about it, and they expect it to be part of the public consciousness. But it disappears, and 100 years later, somebody writes about it all over again as if it were for the first time. Do you wonder what makes something stick?
Well, I think history is not only in the eyes of the retailer, but it's very much a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's such a consciousness that women don't invent that any time an exception to that rule is brought up, it just sort of conveniently slips between the cracks because it goes contrary to the accepted public consciousness. I don't think there's a cosmic conspiracy involving this. I think it's just the way people think.
In our introduction of her book, we have a quote from C.D. Tuska, Mr. C.D. Tuska, who was at that point when he wrote his book, the director of RCA Patent Operations. And his attitude towards women inventors was something to the effect that, well, I'm not going to write about any women inventors because I'm sure there aren't any. Their main function is just having women inventors. In other words, having children. And that is the best invention that they can possibly hope for. So even within the last 30 to 40 years, I think, the public's consciousness about women and what they can do has changed remarkably, so that now it can be accepted that there is such a thing as women inventors, and that women, the women inventors that we've always known about, the very few, for instance, Marie Curie, are not an anomaly.
Would you like to invent something?
I would love to invent something. I'm a jerry rigger. I'm always finding a better way to do something with spit and baling wire and odd pieces of string, but I've never patented anything.
I had a conversation yesterday with a cashier in a checkout line, and she was complaining how it was very difficult to read the number on my credit card. She needed it to put on the back of the check. And so we just briefly started discussing it. She said, well, wouldn't it be a good idea if there were voice-activated credit cards and you would just touch it and the number would be read back to you? So, I mean, I think all of us, even cashiers in checkout lines or even authors of books on women inventors, have ideas for inventions. It's just a matter of pursuing them. And the women in our book pursued them against all sorts of odds that we don't encounter today.
Greg Patechik and Ethel Ann Vare are the authors of Mothers of Invention, From the Bra to the Bomb, published by Morrow. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Faith.
What are you working on?
Well, Jimmy Swaggart is back in the news tonight. The National Assemblies of God has overridden the Louisiana church and banished the Reverend Swaggart from the pulpit for at least a year. His previous punishment had been for 3 months. The National Church also says that tapes of his sermons, and there are lots of tapes, cannot be played for at least a year, and all of this is bound to cost the TV evangelist really millions of dollars in lost revenues, and it may mean that he'll bolt from the church, the National Church. Also in Paris, the Arc de Triomphe is crumbling, and we have a story on that.
Very interesting. Thanks. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of The Ark Sakura, a new novel by Kobo Abe, one of Japan's preeminent authors. It deals with subjects both surreal and subterranean.
When I met Kobo Abe 6 years ago in Japan, he was blocked. In Japan, his novels were considered too Western, even Woman in the Dunes, and especially The Ruined Map. In the West, we seem to prefer our Japanese fiction exotic and cute, with haiku and foot fetishes like Kawabata, or bloody-minded and pornographic, like Mishima. And 100 Years of Solitude had just been translated into Japanese. Gabriel Garcia Marquez was exactly Abe's age, and so much his superior that Abe couldn't write another word on his new novel about nuclear war. The day after this meeting, Marquez won a Nobel Prize. I was frantic, knowing what Japanese writers do when they're depressed. Kawabata took gas, Mishima fell on a sword. I called Abe's wife. He was happily, surprisingly, back at work. She explained, Garcia Marquez has joined the company of the immortals. Abe is no longer in competition with him. The Ark Sakura is the anti-utopian novel Abe went back to work on, a weird and wonderful Karl Marx Brothers comedy in which everything that can go wrong, socially and politically, promptly does so. Meet Pig, who calls himself Mole. He's a shy, fat, idealistic, and sexually frustrated genius. He lives underground, in a rock quarry, in a network of abandoned mines, quote, so full of tunnels and caves, it's like being in the middle of a gigantic trumpet. Pig's fixed up this underground as a nuclear bomb shelter, a Noah's Ark against the end of history. He is invaded by his gangster father, by a con man and two shills called Sakuras, who have their own reasons for hiding from society, by a broom brigade of old men who sing war songs as they sweep the city streets at night, and by a dozen Japanese junior high school girls pursued by everybody else through Pig's caverns for sinister sexual purposes. While most of this is going on, Pig is stuck in a sort of cosmic toilet that flushes dead bodies and toxic wastes out to sea. With one foot in the purifying void, he has a lot to think about. Obviously, we are deep in meanings. Westerners will read the Ark as a spaceship Earth, a Jungian cave, a Borges labyrinth, an upside-down Egyptian pyramid, even a People's Republic. Orientals will have an entirely different set of symbolic references. Japanese cities, for instance, have always had a garbage problem. Fun is also being made of Mishima. The underground recapitulates in farce above-ground histories of religion, political science, Oedipal rage, and human sacrifice. The old hate the young. Artists are con men, and even whales commit suicide. Pig's problem, and ours, is how to escape being what Abe calls a clock bug, a perpetual motion insect that thrives on a diet of its own feces, circling always to face the sun, eating as it eliminates. Clearly, Abe's borrowed his pig from Orwell's Animal Farm, and the Ark Sakura is his slapstick 1984. And reading Garcia Marquez was good for him. Somehow, as if by magical realism, he's learned to loosen up and laugh at the clock bugs, all of us whose only history is our own appetite. Burrowing underground, we eat ourselves to death.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Ark Sakura by Kobo Abe. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with the British novelist and screenwriter Faye Weldon. Her latest novel, The Hearts and Lives of Men, was written in weekly installments for a British magazine. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the recorded work of the Tallis Scholars, a group of British singers who perform unaccompanied Renaissance choral music. And humorist Alice Kahn shares her fantasy about being a singer. Ballad, torch, backup, you name it, she'll sing it. Hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Kathy Anderson. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.